This is The Guardian.
Today, Kherson is liberated. What next for the war in Ukraine? The Ukrainian president treated this as a moment to savor.
I'm happy we are in Kherson.
Dressed simply in a green puffer jacket and combat trousers, Volodymyr Zelensky ambled through the center of Kherson, a city that had for 8 months been under Russian control.
The people waited for Ukrainian army, for our soldiers, for all of us.
Where Ukrainian people had been tortured, tens of thousands forced from their homes, where everything they owned, from cars down to their children's toys, had been ransacked by Russian troops. On Thursday, those troops were finally sent back. And the Ukrainian people reclaimed their city.
142-й центр прилітає з Херсона!
A Ukrainian soldier walked among the crowds. In one arm, he cradled a watermelon, the fruit that has come to symbolize this region, that has continued to grow, green and plump, as this bloody, destructive war has gone on. We endured, he said, for our future. Kherson, which is in the south of Ukraine, bordering Crimea, is the only regional capital the Russian forces had taken in this conflict. And they're losing it, President Zelensky said, marked the beginning of the end of the war. The Guardian's foreign correspondent Luke Harding has been in Ukraine both in the lead-up to and after this withdrawal, and has seen how Kherson has become central to Russia's campaign.
It was supposed to be a kind of key part of Putin's new imperium. And back in September, Putin said that Kherson, the surrounding province, they were now Russia. And not only were they Russia, they would be Russian territory forever. Now, if you fast forward to where we are now, this dream, this irredentist fantasy of a greater Russia in which all of southern Ukraine would be part of Russian territory has come crashing down.
Yesterday, the Russian forces retaliated. They fired missiles into Ukraine, two of which, according to US intelligence, strayed into Poland and killed at least two people. In Kherson, it'll be in the weeks and months to come that we'll begin to see the reality of the damage they've left there, what they did to people, and why many didn't survive. From The Guardian, I'm Hannah Moore. Today in focus, reclaiming Kherson, what Russia's retreat tells us about the fight for Ukraine. Luke, we're recording this the day after Russia announced that it was withdrawing its troops from Kherson. And I know that at the moment you're staying in an area just northeast of the city. Can you tell me, first of all, I mean, had there been any signs in the lead up to this withdrawal that the Russian forces were losing power in that area?
It's been a really incredible and fast moving week. I mean, we've known actually really, I would say, since second half of October that it was probable the Russians were going to pull out of Kherson city and the surrounding province on the right bank of the Dnieper. And you didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to work out the clues. I mean, the Russian troops started taking away cultural relics and monuments. They grubbed up the bones of Grigory Potemkin, or Potemkin, who was Catherine the Great's friend and lover, which were at Kherson's main cathedral in a crypt. There was an art gallery, rather a good one, but the Russians last week loaded all of the exhibits, several thousand of them, onto trucks and stole them. I suspect we'll never see those again. And also the Russian flag was taken down from several key buildings, including the main administration building. So it looked as if something was happening.
And what was the purpose of all the looting? Is that an attempt to sort of wipe out Ukrainian cultural heritage?
I think, one, the Russians have looted because they can loot. But then separately, there's been an attempt to erase the symbols of Ukrainian statehood. So, for example, in one Kherson region village I visited this week, they'd blown up a statue of Taras Shevchenko, Ukraine's national poet, leaving behind a kind of weird column stump. You know, in areas they were planning to govern forever, they burned all the Ukrainian books and introduced a Russian curriculum, which gave the Kremlin's sort of mangled version of history. They banned the Ukrainian language. And really, it's a process of national erasure.
They've clearly been preparing to leave for a while then. What had happened in terms of the development of the war to get the Russians to that point?
I think what sort of changed things from a war perspective is really just the sort of delivery of modern, high-precision Western weapons. Earlier this week, I was with the 63rd Brigade, who've been fighting in Kherson and Mykolaiv province, and I was watching three drone operators play with a screen with joysticks and call in artillery strikes on Russian positions. And so what's happened is that very clinically, the Ukrainians have been rubbing out Russian logistics, destroying fuel dumps, bases, whacking the bridges over the Dnieper River, to the point where supplying Kherson for the Russians was almost impossible. And sort of sooner or later, this was going to happen.
On the surface of it, this seems like a huge setback for the Russian government. How is Putin framing what's happened?
I mean, the Kremlin never admits fault or defeat. I mean, the withdrawal from Kherson was presented as a necessary tactical move.
Предлагается занять оборону по левому берегу реки Днепр.
And there was a 8-minute video of the general in overall charge of the war and Sergei Shoigu, his defense minister.
Сергей Владимирович, согласен с вашими выводами и предложениями.
And it was all very stagey and a bit weird, but I think it was the body language which told the story. I mean, they both looked terrible.
И в целом боеспособность группировки войск.
And wooden.
Держать которую на правом берегу в ограниченном районе.
Pretty miserable. I mean, Russia is going backwards, and this fact is really, it's no longer possible to conceal that from the Russian public. I mean, even though the war is being presented in stridently patriotic terms, still, you know, Shoigu has to explain why Russia is not prevailing. And one interesting thing is how this is all going down in Russia, and the answer is very badly. A sort of patriotic nationalist bloggers are furious about the way that the Russian military operation has been unravelling.
How significant is this then for Ukraine?
It's really a big moment for Ukraine's armed forces. And certainly the Ukrainians I've talked to, the soldiers, the officers, their morale is really high. And I mean, I think this is one of three defining moments in the war so far. The first was the Russian failure to take Kyiv.
The battered ruins of Russian military vehicles are scattered outside Kyiv this morning. But a U.S. military official tells NBC News all Russian troops have left the region.
And definitely the plan was to send in paratroopers to secure government buildings, to kill or arrest Zelensky, to install a pro-Russian puppet administration, and to take over the entire country. That was the plan. That failed. I think the sort of second big failure was in the northeast.
Ukraine appears to have won the battle for its second biggest city, Kharkiv. It says Russia has failed in its efforts to encircle the city. And now
Russian armoured vehicles for about 3 days sort of entered the centre of Kharkiv with a view to taking that as well. That also failed. And really, the third big failure was Russia's inability to hold on to Kherson. I mean, it's the only regional capital that they controlled, and they've been forced to reluctantly abandon it. And this does feel like a pretty uplifting and rousing moment.
Still, this is a region that's been under Russian occupation almost since the start of the war 8 months ago. For the people who've stayed in Kherson during that time, what's it been like for them?
So over the last few days, I've been touring parts of the Mykolaiv region and the Kherson region. They border each other, which were liberated about a month ago by Ukrainian troops. They clawed back 88 villages and towns, and it's a prodigious mess. At least half of the houses have been destroyed. You've got roofless cottages, wonky electricity pylons, abandoned Russian armored equipment by the side of the road, tanks with holes in them burnt out, the odd car with a V sign on it, which is the symbol of Vladimir Putin's faltering invasion, and also sort of traumatized residents. I mean, I was in another pulverized village called Arkhangelsk and found a group of pensioners, most of them women. And they basically said it was a nightmare. I mean, it wasn't just the stealing, it was also the killing. A woman called Lena in her late 60s said that two married couples had been executed and the Russians had killed them because these residents had seen them stealing and carting off the contents from a private house and just gunned them down in cold blood. What's interesting about this is, having reported from Ukraine really for almost a year now, and having been in Bucha and in Mariupol and in liberated parts of Kharkiv province in the northeast, it's the same tragic picture of some residents disappearing, others being murdered in custody and tortured first, and very often people being shot for no reason whatsoever.
In the city, in Kherson itself, again, we're only speaking within 24 hours of Russia announcing its withdrawal. And undoubtedly, you know, more details are going to come out of what's happened. Before the war, the city had a population of about 300,000 people. And now it's estimated to only be about 50 to 60,000. What's happened to those people during the Russian occupation?
What we've seen, and there have been multiple accounts of this, that the Russians have very clinically and systematically been searching and arresting and torturing and in some cases killing anyone they think who has a kind of pro-Ukrainian civic position inside Kherson. So we're talking about teachers, journalists, former soldiers, policemen, municipal officials. I was in Kiev last week and I went to a press conference held by a human rights organization, and there was a woman there called Aliona Labchuk, who's from Kherson, who was talking about what happened to her husband, Vitaly, who was a sort of senior policeman. And he was delivering humanitarian supplies in late March after the Russians had come in, and he didn't come back for several hours. And then the Russians sort of rolled in their armored vehicles with Vitaly, her husband, who was bleeding. They'd beaten him up. His nose had been broken. They searched their property, dragged her, their 19-year-old son, and Vitaly off to the police station with bags over their heads.
Gosh.
And she was sort of discharged in the middle of the night, came back to her house to discover that they'd blown it up with a Russian rocket. She left in April not knowing where her husband was. And then in May, she got a call from a forensic doctor, and a fisherman had been diving for crayfish in the Dnieper River and had found a body of a man with his legs tied together with a heavy object dumped in the water. And he was identified as Vitaly through a mark on his left forearm. And what you have to understand is, this is what Russian occupation means. It means that you can be dragged from your home, you can be tortured, you can be murdered, you can be disappeared, you can be threatened with rape. It's just a sad and terrible story. And I think the full story of Kherson and life under occupation is yet to be fully told.
What else have the Russian forces done with people who stayed?
The other facet to this story is what the Russians have been doing in the run-up to their pullout, which is to forcibly deport people, basically make them leave their houses. They've been bombarding them with messages saying they have to get out, that they're in danger, that the Russian state will take care of them. And a lot of pensioners have gone, some families have gone, some children have gone, and they've been relocated to freezing sanatoria in southern parts of Kherson province near to Crimea. Some have gone to Crimea themselves and have been dumped in holiday camps. Others have been pushed further east towards Krasnodar and even to Siberia.
The deportation and forcible transfer of civilians in occupied territory are prohibited by international humanitarian law and could constitute war crimes or crimes against humanity. In a new report published by Amnesty International on the war in Ukraine, this activity has been a regular feature in the treatment of Ukrainian civilians by Russia.
And as well as the deportations, we've seen children being stolen. There have been parents who sent their kids in the summer to holiday camps in Crimea and never got them back. There's so much tragedy, it's hard to process. And for the individuals caught up in it, it's just been an unthinkable period.
By Friday, the day after I first spoke to Luke, Ukrainian flags were being raised again in Kherson City. Russian troops were leaving in what looked like chaos, and Ukrainian soldiers were coming in, triumphant, singing songs. And by that evening, Volodymyr Zelensky had spoken to the nation, declaring it an historic day.
Історичний день. Ми повертаємо південь нашої країни. Повертаємо Херсон.
I caught up with Luke again yesterday. So Luke, where did you go after we last spoke? And what did you see?
I went to a newly liberated village called Mialova on the banks of the Dnieper River. This village community of about 1,000 people before the war, 300 had stayed, and it was really an astonishing day. I mean, we were the first journalists to arrive there. I mean, to get there, you had to go through the sort of shattered landscape littered with abandoned Russian infantry fighting vehicles. They'd blown the bridge to get to Mialova, so we had to kind of detour through a field of black sunflowers, following a car very carefully because we were worried about mines going past abandoned Russian positions, spooky trenches with artillery shells just kind of lying in the dirt, and the noise of war all around. I mean, it was mostly, it seemed to be Ukrainian fire with kind of boom, boom, boom. And what was also clear to me was how close the new front line is, how close the positions are.
This is Russia.
That's Russia. Okay, Russian controlled territory. Okay.
Left
bank. This is right bank.
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, the Russians were a few kilometres across this expanse of water.
It's a Gromka suchasta. Yes.
And I started chatting to a couple, the Demchuks. A boom went off somewhere nearby, and you know, the husband said, "Oh yeah, we're used to these booms."
Вам не страшно? You're not afraid?
Мы просто не видели.
Страшно, да? Вам страшно? That's you're afraid, yeah.
And the wife, Alessia, immediately took issue with him and said, "No, we're not used to it. It's terrible." And there were Ukrainian military police who were going house to house. The residents had put flags out.
And the military police that are going door to door, what are they doing?
Well, the military police were looking for collaborators, I think, and trying to figure out who was who. And I immediately started talking to someone called Sergei Melnikov, who said he'd been there for 245 days, all the way through the occupation. And he said that basically about 10 people out of the 300 collaborated, including a woman who became the informal village pro-Russian mayor who told the Russian soldiers where to stay. And a group of them, they were living opposite his house.
I'm at number 6, Shevchenko Street, basically a place where the Russian soldiers live for 8-9 months. And it's quite surreal. I mean, they left 2 days ago. You can see the coffee cups where they were drinking and rubbish, Russian army ration packs, sardines, a shoe. And they had a storeroom where they put their grenades and their shells.
This mighty army had fled about 5 a.m. on Wednesday morning of last week. They packed up in 5 minutes. And he said, Sergei Melnikov, he said they ran away like goats. And that was the end of, occupation. But they were very brave. I mean, Melnikov said that he could get phone reception on his roof, and he would go up to the roof above a yard of geese. And when he saw Russian hardware, he would secretly pass the coordinates by text message to his son, who lived in Dnipro, big city under Ukrainian control, who would pass it to the Ukrainian army. And on several occasions, he would pass the coordinates, and there would then be a Ukrainian airstrike. So they were all waiting for the Ukrainian army. But actually, when it arrived, it was just a moment of euphoria. That there were women I saw who were handing out homemade pastries, but also there was anger and sadness at what the Russians had done. I mean, Sergei said that he compared them to tramps. They were drunken, they were roaming around looking for booze, asking for girls, and they smashed everything up. I mean, they lived in the village school and nurseries, and they blew them up. They looted all of the shops. Basically, the village was left with nothing.
Since the Ukrainian troops retook the city, what kind of state have they found it in?
Well, because the Russians actually evacuated, actually Kherson is largely intact. I mean, some things have been blown up, TV towers. I mean, there is some damage, but not on the scale of Mariupol. I mean, the city has not been levelled or razed. But what's remarkable is how quickly Ukraine is scrambling to try and bring back normal life. A train connection, we think in the next couple of weeks, there are now mobile phone, Kyiv Star is operating again. There are Wi-Fi hotspots which have sprung up.
So that's a kind of forward motion, but looking at the investigators who are coming in, looking at what's been going on in this city for 8 months, what evidence have they found of what's happened to the people there?
But we're already hearing cases of abduction and torture. We also hear that they let all the inmates out of the prison.
The Russians let everybody out of the prison?
Yeah, they let everyone out of the prison, apart from the sort of political internees who they took with them to Crimea. There was also extraordinary footage which has emerged that they stole the contents of the zoo, and they stole the zoo's raccoon and the llamas, which were shoved into a bus and driven off to Crimea.
And I know that Volodymyr Zelensky and other Ukrainian officials have, you know, at the same time as celebrating this victory, also raised a note of caution that some Russian soldiers may be hiding out in the city still, disguised as civilians. Has any evidence of that actually come out?
Well, I mean, a few Russian soldiers have been captured. There's also quite significant evidence that quite a few tried to swim across the Dnieper and may have drowned. I mean, that there are abandoned uniforms, flak jackets, weapons by the bank of the river. What I do think will go on is that there will be, the Russians will try and destroy Kherson from across the river and shell it. And certainly there was a lot of, when I was there a couple of days ago, there was a lot of military activity, a lot of noise. And clearly, what the Ukrainians are going to do, I think, is very quickly try and knock out Russian artillery positions within striking range of Kherson, so the city can actually function without being terrorised.
In terms of the safety of people there, those who've stayed, those who are thinking about returning, you know, are the troops going to have to go in and demine the area?
There's an enormous amount of demining going on, and I was just before we spoke, I was looking at the local Telegram channels, and close to where I was in Mielova, the next village along, it's called Novokary, a car full of kids went over a mine yesterday. All the kids in the hospital, they appear to be alive. I don't know how badly hurt they are, and this is a problem all over. I mean, the Russians have mined everything. They've left booby traps. So there's an enormous process going on at the moment, which will take weeks and months, I think, to complete.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, as you're driving through that area, like, how did it feel to you? Do you feel scared?
It felt terrifying, to be honest. I mean, there was one moment coming out of Mielova and an enormous Ukrainian military column was coming towards us with several T-72 tanks. And to let it go past, we had to kind of pull off the road into a field. And you just take a deep breath and hope that you're going to be okay. We were okay. But clearly, it's a pretty dangerous environment. And first and foremost, for the civilians who live there.
So President Zelensky, he's been speaking at the G20 summit this week.
Ukraine wants peace. Europe wants peace. The world wants peace. And we have seen who is the only one who wants war.
What can he do to try and get momentum behind him, to try and build on this victory and try and push further for this war to end?
Well, I think what Zelensky needs and what he's been signalling is that they need more weapons. I mean, they're burning through ammunition and offensive stuff at the most extraordinary rate. So he needs more stuff from the West to finish the job. And also, I think, to understand the Ukrainian concept of victory, which is to drive Russia out of Ukrainian territory once and for all.
Zelensky also outlining a peace proposal which includes the end to nuclear threats, more food and energy security, prisoner swaps, and a full withdrawal by Russia.
And Zelensky's been very clear about what Ukraine wants, which is all of its territory back, Russia to pay reparations, and justice. I mean, that's the other interesting thing, is some kind of accountability. There have been so many war crimes.
What did you make of the responses that he got from other world leaders then at the G20?
Well, India and China have largely been sitting this war out, actually, and India's been importing an awful lot of Russian oil as well at cut prices. They were perhaps a little bit more supportive than they've been previously. Meanwhile, the German government of Olaf Scholz is now offering to train Ukrainian soldiers in Berlin and to repair broken down military kit. The big fact is that the anti-Kremlin, the anti-Putin coalition, for now, I think, it's united.
Coming up, how could what's happened in Kherson change the course of this war? Luke, how significant will what's happened in Kherson be to what happens next in this war?
I mean, Russia still occupies a significant amount of Ukrainian territory. But I mean, I think the question now going forward is, can they hold on to it? And my hunch is that the Ukrainians will try and sort of strike next around Zaporizhia and Melitopol and try and sort of open a third front there. There's fighting still going on in the east, there's fighting in the south. But one other thing about this war is that the Ukrainians are very good at surprises. We've seen a series of spectacular, almost theatrical attacks. The Crimean bridge linking the Russian mainland with occupied Crimea got blown up. Mm. We've seen an attack on the port of Sevastopol in Crimea, occupied by Russia, using ingenious sea drones. And I'm pretty certain my Ukrainian sources tell me that more of this kind of operation is coming. Basically, Russia has not given up. It's suffered a setback in Kherson, but the Russian military is still formidable. In the wake of Russia's retreat from Kherson, we've seen very predictably massive missile strikes from Moscow across Ukraine on infrastructure, specifically on power, on electricity substations. And Putin, if he is able to, will come back and try and reconquer the parts of Ukraine that he's lost. And I think Putin's calculation certainly is that sooner or later the West will tire of this war, and possibly the supply of weaponry to Ukraine will drop off.
Is that likely? I mean, what is the international response to this, to the withdrawal from Kherson?
I mean, I think the Russian debacle in and around Kherson vindicates the strategy of the democratic world to support Ukraine, because Putin basically, he believed that the West was divided, that it was weak, that actually he could march into Ukraine and there wouldn't be much of a response. It would be similar to what happened in Crimea in 2014, which was not much. And actually, the anti-Kremlin international coalition has been surprisingly robust, and they have been punching holes in this kind of, you know, mighty golem, which is the Russian army.
And finally, Luke, thinking of the people that you've met who've remained in the region, how do they hope its future will be in the months to come?
I was talking to a pensioner called Nikolai Bogun, who lived on the front line in Mala Alexandrovka. And the walls of Nikolai's home are decorated with portraits of his family, including his grandchildren. And one of them, 23-year-old Maxim, was killed in the spring in a Russian rocket attack. And you know, he was telling me the story, sitting on the sofa of his house with, you know, the whoomp of artillery going on all around us. And yeah, he was crying, and he just sort of said, I just want peace, you know, different flags, different uniforms, you know, soldiers coming and going. We just want peace. And, you know, people do want peace. They want reconstruction. They want the basic necessities of life, whether it's electricity, water, heating, all of which are missing in these areas trashed by Russia. And so, of course, Kherson being liberated is a big moment. But to actually bring back proper life, proper schools, proper happiness, it's going to take time. So the stakes are enormous. The tragedies are vast. But for now, I think Ukraine is in good spirits, and they haven't won yet, but I think the shape of victory is beginning to coalesce.
Luke, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Luke Harding. Please do keep up with his reporting at theguardian.com. This episode was produced by Rose Delurabiti and sound designed by Rudy Zagadlo. The executive producer was Huma Khalili. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.